Hello there and welcome. Today is Tuesday, November the 8th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, in a matter of hours now, Americans will start voting for a new president.
We are going to win back the White House.
I want us to have a vision that is hopeful, optimistic, and unified about what we can do together to make sure America's best years are ahead of us.
What, if any, impact has the FBI had on the U.S. election? New York City preparing for both candidates on election night. And also ahead, conservation programs return turtles and orangutans to the wild. It's all on today's International Edition. We are now just hours away from the first polls opening, and as many are as American voters get ready to make their choice for who they want to be the 45th president of the United States. International Edition's Michael Lippin talks to VOA national correspondent Jim Malone about where the race stands.
From the polls that we see a modest but steady lead for Hillary Clinton. Most margins are in the 3 to 5 point area, though I must say, in terms of a national race at this late stage, if it's up to five, that's a pretty significant number. It looks like in the last 5 to 7 days, Clinton has rebounded a bit from an earlier Trump surge. So in the final days here, she's putting some distance between herself and Trump, but many of the key state polls are still close. Trump is within perhaps striking distance. But at this late stage of the race, he would really have to have a big surge at the end, not only nationally, but in these key states, places like Michigan, Pennsylvania, Ohio, and Florida, where they are spending most of their time.
Well, speaking of spending time, what is Trump doing this day before Election Day to try to boost support in those battleground states?
He's hitting a number of the key states that will decide the outcome of the race. He's hitting places like North Carolina, Michigan, Pennsylvania. Trump really needs to win some of the bigger battleground states at stake where the race is very close, place like Florida, like Ohio. He's been leading in Ohio, though the margin there may be getting more narrow by the day. And the other issue here is on the Democratic side, the Clinton turnout machine to get voters out to the polls is considered much better than what Trump has. Trump is really relying on the Republican National Committee. And historically, they're not quite as proficient at getting out those voters at the last minute.
He also says he's got a lot of enthusiasm, too. How much does that factor in?
It could, you know. A lot of the polls show a gap there where Trump supporters say they're more enthusiastic. But we saw this 4 years ago, too. Romney voters were said to be more enthusiastic. But then the Obama supporters exceeded the predictions at the polls. Obama was favored by less than 1 point in the final average of polls in 2012. He won by 4. If we see that same kind of gap this time for Clinton, it could be a much bigger gap. But right now, the race appears to be reasonably close. But Trump really has to run the table, so to speak, win all these close battleground states at the end.
Well, what is Hillary Clinton going to do on this Monday to try to keep her edge in some of these states?
She's really focused on Democratic-leaning states that have gone for the Democratic Party in presidential elections since 1992. We're talking places like Pennsylvania and Michigan. She really wants to nail down states where if Trump were able to win one of them, I think it would upset the apple cart and give him a route to the magic number of 270 in the Electoral College. So to some extent, the Democrats are playing defense here at the end. They're not as focused on typically Republican states like Arizona and Georgia, where she's still reasonably close in the polls.
Thank you so much to our national correspondent, Jim Malone, speaking with us on Election Eve.
Thank you.
All right, well, turning now to what's trending on social media today. No doubt it's related to the election. G. Abby Lee joining me now. Hi, G.
Hi, Lori.
We are now hours away from the U.S. presidential election. Mm-hmm. What are you hearing?
So the Moments section of Twitter curated 15 of the most popular tweets from Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, respectively, and the popularity is calculated by the number of likes and retweets.
That is a lot of tweets to go through,
right.
So tell us the gist of it.
Sure. So interestingly enough, the most popular tweets from both candidates were interactions between the two. After President Barack Obama endorsed Clinton back in June, Trump took to Twitter to share his reaction. He tweeted, "Obama just endorsed crooked Hillary. He wants 4 more years of Obama, but nobody else does." Now, to that, Clinton replied, "Delete your account." The rest of Clinton's most popular tweets were mainly fact-checking tweets about Trump's claims on global warming and respect for women.
Okay, so what about Trump's tweets?
The most popular one is a reply to her "delete your account" tweet. He responded by sending this tweet. "How long did it take your staff of 823 people to think that up? And where are your 33,000 emails that you deleted?" His other popular tweets included one lamenting the media's criticism about his wife Melania Trump's speech that closely resembled that of First Lady Michelle Obama's.
Oh, wow. Well, I know the election is huge, so what else is trending?
Trump surrogate Scotty Nell Hughes accidentally created a new drink.
Uh-oh.
During an interview with CNN, Hughes criticized rapper Jay-Z's music video for allegedly containing Mazel Tov cocktail.
What?
She meant to say Molotov cocktail, a simple bomb in a bottle, but she said it wrong, and of course the internet ran with
it. That's funny.
American dictionary company Merriam-Webster sent out this tweet. "No, we have no idea what a Mazel Tov cocktail is." But other people did. A lot of Jewish people took to Twitter and shared their 2 cents on what should be in the so-called Mazel Tov cocktail.
That's funny. Of course, Mazel Tov is Yiddish for...
cheers, I guess. Congratulations. Right.
Yep.
Well, mazel to that. That's all for me today. Lori?
All right. Thanks so much, G. You can follow her at G. Abby Lee. Here are some of the stories we are following at voanews.com. Researchers develop a hard-to-hack election machine. The election is a source of significant stress. The next U.S. president faces a divided country no matter who wins. Indonesia is poised to pass Asia's first right-to-be-forgotten law. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Well, the world is watching the U.S. presidential election intensely, and that includes Europe. Joining me now for that part of the story, Paris-based journalist Catherine Field. Catherine, how closely are people paying attention to this?
They are following it so closely. The major point that people are talking about, and I'm not just talking about sort of think tanks, politicians, but also the guy on the street, is realizing that if Donald Trump wins the presidential elections, that the world will change for Europe. Europe has relied on America so much as a real firm ally since the end of the Second World War, an ally that came out of the Second World War, an ally that helped set up NATO. NATO's founding principle was that we're all together, an attack against one is an attack against us all. We all come to everyone's defense. And the fact that Donald Trump, in his earlier rallies, had said that, well, some of these NATO allies are freeloaders, they're riding on U.S. coattails, they're not paying their dues, and the fact that he actually questioned that NATO founding principle has shaken a lot of people to the core. They're just wandering around saying, is this what it really means? Is this what it's going to be? On top of that, the fact that Donald Trump regards the European Union as somewhat in decline, as sort of a lesser partner, is worrying, because whilst everyone knows that the European Union is having a tough time at the moment, it's worried about populism, it's worried about migration, it's worrying about economic stagnation, it's worrying about Brexit, it is still something which works. It's an identity. It is who Europe is. And the fact that Donald Trump talks about having good relations with the Russian president, President Putin, really does worry Europeans. And as well as all these other issues that the European Union has to deal with, it is also having to deal with Russian provocations, whether it be in Crimea, whether it be in Syria, or whether it just be over energy resources to Western Europe from Russia. These are matters which Europeans deal with on a daily basis. So the idea that an American president could put all this up for grabs and decide that Putin is right, Europe just needs to come on board, that really does worry people.
And you also mentioned Brexit. There's been some issues with that in recent days as well. What's the talk about the whole Brexit thing potentially falling apart?
Well, when it comes to Brexit, mostly the French and the Germans have got together and said, this cannot go any further. Brexit just remains in Brexit. It is only the United Kingdom which leaves. What it has is, especially in the last few days when people have been talking about a tough Brexit, a soft Brexit, be nice to the United Kingdom because at the end of the day, they're still part of Europe. They will still be Europe's neighbors. Geographically, they're still European. There has been an idea that, well, you do have to deal with the problems that are part of the European Union. That is sort of both the bureaucracy and telling people what the European Union stands for and how it has changed people's lives, mostly for the best. Free movement of people, free movement of goods, people being able to trade without barriers. These are really pluses, if you like, of the European Union that people have taken for granted. And that's got, if you like, mixed in with this populism that's happening in France and Germany and particularly in the United Kingdom, where people have started talking about, well, we'll be better on our own. So, you know, France and Germany have pretty much got together and said, okay, we need to be tough, we need to be strong, and we need to make it clear that the only way that a strong Europe can prevail is if everyone sticks together.
Just briefly going back to the U.S. election, have you met any American expats over there? And if so, what have they said about the election?
Again, a mixed bag. I've met a lot of Americans who are Democrats who have really been getting out to vote. For example, just last week when I was coming through the Eurostar tunnel, you know, the train that connects London and Paris, I was at the Eurostar terminal in London, and there were two Americans standing there, you know, where people went in, holding up banners saying, please vote, don't forget you've got to vote, you have to vote. So it was very interesting to see that they've actually been getting out and getting the vote going. Here in Paris, of course, there are, you know, American-style bars that have already set up and been taking reservations for election night, having their own straw polls, making sure that people will be following the election here, and it won't just be in the foreign ministries of the various European capitals.
All right. Well, we appreciate your perspective. Paris-based journalist Catherine Field, thank you for joining us. FBI Director James Comey told Congress a new review of emails related to Hillary Clinton's tenure as Secretary of State revealed no evidence of criminal activity. But was the damage of his previous announcement already done? I talk about that now with Richard Painter, former Bush White House chief ethics lawyer. Thank you for being with us. What is your take on the FBI director's about-face on all of this?
I think it was very unwise, and as I explained in my complaint to the Office of Special Counsel, I think a violation of the Hatch Act for the FBI to be making any announcement about an investigation that concerned either Mrs. Clinton or Mr. Trump this close to the election. That being said, I think the clarification certainly helps, and that we now know what we really knew from the beginning is that there was no real new information that the FBI had. They didn't have new information when they had the first letter was written because they had not even obtained a search warrant with respect to the laptop. And then they've looked at the laptop and they haven't found anything new. So we're back to square one, but there's unfortunately been a big disruption of the election and millions of Americans have already voted. So we hope that this would never happen again, that the FBI wouldn't play this type of role in an election again.
So do you think the fact that he came back so quickly and said, they have not learned anything new, there are no charges, that type of thing, does that sort of give an indication that maybe he jumped the gun and pulled the trigger too quickly?
Well, yes. The chances that there was going to be anything new on that laptop were very, very low. And most all the emails were likely to be emails that they are already seeing going out of the Clinton server. And that indeed appears to be the case. And to the extent there are any new emails, they probably don't contain classified information. And then we also know that the FBI looked at this before, and there is no precedent for prosecution for negligent handling of classified information. And if there were negligence, it would have been across the State Department, and particularly the individuals who sent classified emails. So you put all that together, and I think it's quite clear from the beginning that this new computer would have no impact on the conclusions that the FBI reached in July.
We've heard a lot also in the past week or so about possible partisan maneuvering within the FBI. Lots of mistrust going on both sides. Mainly, we're hearing a lot that maybe there were some anti-Clinton, Trump supporters within the FBI that may have influenced FBI Director James Comey. What do you know about that, and what do you think of it?
Well, we just don't know. I think the most significant influence on Director Comey was the extraordinary pressure from the members of Congress who wanted to use the FBI to investigate their political enemies. And that's been going on for well over a year. They were dissatisfied when they didn't get an indictment and made him promise that he'd come back with any new information, a promise which he never should have made to Congress. So I think the most pressure here is from members of Congress. So we may have some rogue agents of the FBI who are leaking to the press or leaking to Rudy Giuliani, or I don't know what's going on there. But the real problem is the politicized investigation by Congress and the involvement of the FBI in that. And we had this problem when I was in President Bush's White House, of that same committee under the control of liberal Democrats wanting to investigate us all the time for just about everything, including lost email. We've been through it all before, but at least they didn't try to involve the FBI. And the FBI needs to make absolutely sure that they stay away from politicized investigations in the future.
What do you think will happen after the election regarding Mr. Comey?
Well, I think the best thing to happen would be for Congress to have hearings and discuss what went wrong here, and for Congress to realize their role in this, that the FBI should never be subjected to political pressure by the president or by members of Congress with respect to investigations of political opponents. So rather than just focus on Director Comey, what we need to focus is why this happened to begin with and making sure it never happens again.
All right. Richard Painter, former Bush White House chief ethics lawyer, thank you for being with us. Well, as New York prepares to host both major presidential candidates on Tuesday night's election, city and police officials are preparing to protect them. The city itself is a bustling scene filled with marathoners, fans to cheer them on, and election advance teams. All of this coming as security chatter indicates a possible al-Qaeda terror threat. VOA's Carolyn Prasuti brings us the sights and sounds from a very busy but cautious Big Apple.
Who will be our winner on November 8th?
Hillary Clinton supporters in New York City are making last-minute phone calls and sending texts to Democrats in battleground states. With some polls showing Republican Donald Trump closing in on Clinton, it's a race to reach voters.
Really feeling that it's a rush, a mad rush.
Outside, New York City marathoners dashed to the finish line as thousands of police officers guarded them. U.S. intelligence officials said they picked up terrorism chatter of a possible attack on or before the election in the states of Virginia, Texas, and New York. The threat was not specific, but officials here in New York, always on alert, are taking it seriously. Carolyn Maloney is a U.S. Congresswoman from New York.
No one's better at it in any place in the world than New York. We proved that on 9/11, we proved that every day, and we will prove that on Election Day.
The threat is of special significance to New York City because both presidential candidates will be here for their election parties Tuesday night. Clinton at a convention center with a glass ceiling and walls. Trump at a hotel a few blocks from his home at Trump Tower. Anad Ahuja is a Trump supporter.
So everybody is concerned not only about one's own safety, but at the same time, safety of our presidential candidates also.
With the election now just a day away, officials promised to crush any effort to disrupt democracy. Carolyn Prasuti, VOA News, New York City.
You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
On Tuesday, November 8th, all eyes will be on America as voters choose the next U.S. president. Tune in to our live comprehensive coverage with our correspondents around the country and around the world. Starting Tuesday at 2200 hours UTC GMT and continuing through Wednesday morning right here on VOA.
I'm Victor Beatty. Since 1942, the Voice of America has been a consistently reliable and authoritative source of news. Today, VOA remains committed to providing an accurate, objective, and comprehensive news product at the top of every hour, every day. We can be heard on your local affiliate or streamed on the web at voanews.com.
This is VOA's International Edition. While human activities and habitat destruction threaten many species around the world, conservationists are pushing back in many ways, including captive breeding programs and rehabilitation centers working to increase populations and return animals to the wild. Faith Lapidus has details.
These 17,000 hatchlings are yellow-spotted Amazon River turtles, known as tarakayas. While not an endangered species, Peru's government considers them vulnerable. They're threatened by logging activity near rivers, which can destroy their nests. So in August, conservationists and local volunteers collected as many eggs as they could and brought them to safer nesting areas to hatch. The turtles were released this month into their natural habitat in a protected area of northeastern Peru's Amazon River Basin. Tarakayas can grow to almost 3 kilos and live up to 70 years. These little guys have gotten off to a good start. Meanwhile, halfway around the world, a different and much larger species was prepared for its return to the wild. These endangered orangutans were rescued from an Indonesian forest reserve last year when fires caused by slash-and-burn clearing threatened the area. After veterinarians checked their conditions, the animals were placed in cages and moved to an artificial forest owned by the Borneo Orangutan Survival Foundation. Here they'll have a chance to get used to living in the forest again, finding food on their own.
This is the process before they are released to the wild. So if they don't have sufficient food, we can intervene. And if they manage to survive on this stage, we will release them back into the wild.
Since 2012, the foundation has released 229 orangutans back into Indonesia's forests. Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
Well, 2016's New York City Marathon has broken a record for the most marathon finishers, with more than 51,000 runners crossing the finish line in Central Park on Sunday.
Are you ready? Are you ready to run?
On a brilliant autumn morning in New York City, the world's elite runners pounded the pavement to the cheers of fans gathered from near and far. The TCS New York City Marathon had officially begun.
We come every year. Yeah, we always come and cheer everybody on, and it's a lot of fun.
Leading the women's pack was defending champion Mary Kaitani, a petite Kenyan whose diminutive stature belied her commanding stamina. If she succeeded, it would be her third consecutive New York City Marathon win. A few days before the race, she spoke modestly about her prospects.
It's not easy, but for me, if I do it, I think I'll make the history, and for me, it would be nice.
For Kaitani, running was just another day at the office.
I have no job, so my job is actually running. So I have to run, not for my kids to be well.
Fellow Kenyan Lucas Rotich was also thinking about his children back home.
My daughter really like me to go home with her presents. So not only a present, but also something to show him that this is what I got in the race. And that's what's making me to really work hard.
Rotich also knew his daughter wouldn't be the only one watching.
All of the Kenya are watching New York. And I think they don't want to be disappointed. We are representing our country.
Ugandan Moses Kipsiro was running his first New York City marathon, but remembers New Yorkers' energy from a previous race.
All the way, the people are cheering and, coming towards the finishing, you get a lot of support. And, you know, it was something so special that I keep remembering it.
In the end, Kaitani got her third win and Rotich came in second. Gurme Gebrselassie from Eritrea became the youngest ever at 20 years old to take the men's title. Whether runner or spectator, the day's victories were shared by all. Tina Trin, VOA News, New York.
I'm James Butte, host of Daybreak Africa. Join me every weekday mornings at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC as we bring you the latest in African news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of the show through our listeners' mail segment. Just send your views to daybreakafrica@voanews.com or call us on 202-205-9942. That's Daybreak Africa, your breakfast show at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC on The Voice of America.
Do you lead a busy life? Not always able to catch your favorite VOA radio or TV program? If you are keen to stay in touch with world news and events, give VOA podcasts a try.
VOAnews.com.
Visit our website at VOAnews.com to learn how you can become a subscriber to VOA podcasts and keep your life up to date.
VOA News, your trusted source for news and information.
That's going to do it for today's International Edition, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. And of course, join us for our live election coverage all evening. Thank you so much for being with us. Thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Charles Hall. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The latest report by an independent investigative panel of experts confirms that the Assad regime is responsible for a third chemical weapons attack on the Syrian people. In its October 2016 report, the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, United Nations Joint Investigative Mechanism, or JIM, concluded the Syrian Arab Armed Forces used weaponized chlorine in the town of Khmenes in 2015. This latest finding followed an August 2016 report, where the JIM concluded that Syrian Arab Armed Forces used helicopters to drop barrel bombs filled with chlorine gas on the civilian population of Sarmin in 2015 and had attacked the town of Talmenes in a similar way in 2014. That report additionally found that Daesh used mustard gas in an attack in 2015 in Mareya. The leadership panel of the JIM reaffirmed its belief that it is absolutely critical to hold those who use or intend to use chemicals as weapons accountable for their acts. State Department Deputy Spokesperson Mark Toner noted that the JIM's investigation corroborated what we have known for years. The Assad regime has systematically and repeatedly used chemical weapons against its own people. In a statement, U.S. National Security Council spokesperson Ned Price condemned in the strongest possible terms the Assad regime's defiance of the long-standing global norm against chemical weapons use. The United States, he said, continues to work with our international partners to enforce accountability through appropriate diplomatic mechanisms, including through the United Nations Security Council and the OPCW. On October 31st, the UN Security Council unanimously extended, through Resolution 2314, the mandate of the Joint Investigative Mechanism until November 18, 2016, in order to allow additional time for the Security Council to reach agreement on a year-long renewal of the JIM. This renewal would allow the JIM to continue to probe into the documented use of chemical weapons in Syria. U.S. Deputy Permanent Representative to the UN, Ambassador Michelle Sisson, welcomed the Security Council's adoption of Resolution 2314, noting that the Security Council must condemn and hold responsible whoever is involved in these chemical weapons attacks, and the JIM is a key tool to help us do that. National Security Council spokesperson Price said, "We must send a strong signal that the use of weapons of mass destruction will not be tolerated by the international community."
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.